This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or send in your question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org.
Week we talked about the different approaches in psychology and about whether or not opposites attract, and it really made a lot of sense with what you were saying about that relationships are value propositions. So today I want to go over the keys to a successful relationship, and I was looking at some very interesting videos. It was the YouTube author was called How to Get Your Ex Back. So right away, my ears perked up. So I wanted to hear what this guy had to say, and he went over why relationships fail. Let's have a listen. We're going to analyze this. There's four main things that he talks about, and let's just go one by one and just get some opinions from you, and then go from there.
All right. Great. Sounds
all
entertaining.
Right. Yeah, it should be fun. So here's our guy, the dating coach.
Hi guys, Brad Browning here with another video about breakups and relationships. And this time I'm going to talk about why breakups happen, and I'll explain four of the most common things that cause relationships to fail. For most people watching this video, there's a very good chance that one of these four things I'm about to discuss was the main reason behind your breakup, even if your ex told you something differently. Now, there's one very important thing you need to be aware of before I go any further. And that's that your ex almost certainly lied to you after your breakup. 99% of the time, the person who initiated the breakup will lie about why they want to end things. Sometimes it's more of a partial truth than a blatant lie. Sometimes it's even a subconscious lie. But if your ex told you why he or she wanted to break up, I can almost guarantee you that it was a lie, or at the very least, only partially true. This is something I've learned after years of coaching and having worked with thousands of people who are recovering from a breakup. So trust me on this, unless it was something totally obvious that led to your breakup, like your ex, you know, walking in on you while you were naked in bed with the office intern, then you probably don't really know why your ex wanted to break up, because they were most likely lying.
All right, Dr. Lyle, so let's hear it.
Well, actually, he has a point. He's talking about the situation where you have been dumped and the other person has broken up with you. And so very often when people break up with people, it's they go to considerable lengths to essentially soften the blow as to why this is. And the reason, I mean, sometimes they don't. Sometimes people are just relatively – this presupposes some pretty sensitive, pretty decent people. The rough sawed people of the world break up, and they may tell people exactly why as they slam the door and walk out. Okay, but this guy is talking about sort of more sophisticated people, possibly than average, and more emotionally stable people than average, and more socially sensitive people than average, and as a result, those people will tend to, this is what I call the octopus strategy, that they'll throw ink all over the water so that you can't see where they are. And the reasons for this are because very often the reasons for rejecting people are actually fairly objective, in the sense that it's an issue of one party supposing that they are essentially superior to the other party and that they can do better. So at the fundamental level, the reason why people break up is because all relationships are value propositions. And so people are doing cost-benefit analysis on all of their potential alternatives. And so if they break up with you, they simply feel like they can do better. And they've got reasons why they think they can do better. And so that's why they're moving on. And but they may not tell you this because that's essentially the most personal and most hurtful kind of feedback that somebody could give you. So they will very often come up with a story that is, as he says, partially true because they need to have it ring true. And they're doing this in order to essentially spare your feelings of the rejection. So this is no different than why we tell a person who is second place for a job interview or a promotion that they were really excellent and really fine, or let's say the person was fourth place out of 12, and we say they were outstanding, they were right up there close to the top, and it was a really tough decision. We don't say, actually, it was a very easy decision, you weren't even close to the top candidate. We don't say that. So by being sensitive, there's no reason not to essentially give people as good a feedback as we can while we are giving them bad feedback, and this certainly makes some sense.
Now, to the extent that if you did tell the person you're breaking up with some of the truths about their qualities, would they even be able to change them?
Well, the whole point here is that people make an assessment in a relationship about people are well aware of your assets and liabilities as you enter a relationship. And so they may actually sense the possibility that they could actually change you or improve some of the liabilities, or you have cloaked some of your liabilities until a few weeks have gone by, and then those liabilities start coming more to the surface. And so now it starts changing the value proposition. So so it is true that people will essentially people don't sort of pencil out the value of somebody in a very cold mathematical fashion across different domains of life, like looks, brains, and personality. They do it much more impressionistically, and they are not consciously aware of what level of goodness or competitive strength the person has to have in order to be acceptable. So they may start to enter a relationship and they believe that you might be acceptable. But as it turns out, as they get to know you better and they get a feel for what it feels like to be with you, they could actually tell you, well, the problem is, you know, your biceps just aren't big enough. They might actually think that that is a reason, but they might not actually even know for sure. And so if you said, well, now wait a second, I can go to the gym and I can make my biceps bigger. The thing is that essentially what they wind up with is a global rejection where their overall feel towards you is simply not up to standard of what it is that they want to continue. And so it isn't one specific thing that they can put their finger on that is the glaring deficiency. It is usually a more global sense. And so in that way, they couldn't even quite tell you what the issue is. They could tell you what some of the issues were, and they can describe, they could, if they wanted to, coldly recount some of your deficiencies. And incidentally, I've heard that there are some pretty cold, sad excuses for human beings who've done exactly that to people that they've broken up with. But in general, that is not actually what's happening, that the person actually is forming a global impression about how it is that they feel in a relationship with the other person, and they get a feeling for whether or not, incidentally, a very interesting check on whether or not a person is truly acceptable to you is whether or not you are proud to be with them. And so this winds up sometimes being an interesting thing that happens, that as people get to know each other better and they've been with each other maybe a few months, they get a feel with whether or not it feels when they're in the presence of third parties that are significant in some way, whether or not they feel proud of the person that they are with. That is not something a lot of times that they can precisely anticipate how they're going to feel. They just either feel it or they don't feel it, okay? And if they don't feel it, if they're a little bit embarrassed or they're a little bit ashamed, or they're a little bit, you know, just essentially that it doesn't make them feel good, then this is an internal guidance system that is telling them that their mind actually believes that they can do better than they're doing, and they're on their way to breaking up.
In the interest of efficiency, you think it's a good idea for me to have my first dates at family gatherings from now on?
No. I actually could tell you an interesting story. One of the happiest couples that I know, and that is the man. They were both in their mid to late 30s, and so they were both experienced in life and both highly intelligent, very nice looking, competent people. And the man was someone who was always very bold with women and had had a great deal of success with women. And he met this girl and at a lunch and spoke with her for about 15 minutes before she had to leave. Just happened to be in a cafe, and they were the only two people in the cafe. And so they happened to, so he and the waitress of all things sat them very close to each other in the cafe. And so this man actually, started a conversation, was hitting on the young lady, got her phone number. And then when he asked her out a couple weeks later, when he saw her and they spent a little bit of time together, he actually drove that girl over to meet his mother. And of course, that was an incredible thing to have done at that point, particularly in the middle of Los Angeles, which is where this took place. But he knew. He had enough intuition about who this person was and what they were going to be like that his mind ran through the circuits, and it did an unthinkable thing to him. So that will tell you sometimes. You know an awful lot, so in this case, he knew this woman was actually acceptable, that he had met his future wife. She wouldn't know for sure. She wasn't that quick to figure this out. But sometimes when it is outstanding and you can actually sense who the person is and you can sense that they meet all of your critical criteria, you know. And this is the psychologist Nathaniel Brandon, who is one of the great teachers about romantic love process. He didn't know anything about evolution and evolutionary psychology, but he was a very observant person, psychologist. And he called this a shock of recognition. And it's as if you knew a whole bunch of things that you've been looking for your whole life, and you meet them and you see it and you recognize it. And so this can happen. And but when people are dragging their feet and hiding you from their relatives and their important people, that's telling you something. That's an important signal.
All right. Well, let's continue with this clip. The first reason why this speaker claims that relationships fail is neediness. Let's hear why.
Yes. Okay. Let's hear this.
This is a very common trait that many people exhibit in a relationship. While your partner may seem to think it's cute, it's actually one of the biggest relationship killers. Yes, as weird as it sounds, studies have shown that being the clingy girlfriend or boyfriend is actually a massive, massive turnoff. Human beings need a challenge. So when something becomes too easy, it's just human nature to pick up and get going. And this is the sort of survival mechanism. This is our way of saying, find a new challenge. I'm bored. It's ingrained. People also hate feeling tied down and easily get frustrated when somebody is constantly pestering them or requiring their attention. This toxic trait doesn't just happen to women. Men are almost as likely to be guilty of excessive neediness as well.
Yeah. Are you there with me?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. This is a an interesting guy. He he's obviously very ignorant of psychology, but that's okay. That's fair enough. He's sort of been around the block, probably talked to a lot of people, and he's probably read some pop psychology. And so as a result, he's making a classic error in understanding psychological process. He's confusing correlation with causation here. So, of course, if you see a relationship where one person is being very needy, then it's very likely that the other person is looking for the exit. Now, it isn't that the neediness is actually causing this the process. The neediness is a result of the signaling systems, the esteem dynamics that are taking place between the two partners. Okay, so what is the person needy for? This guy would say, well, attention. Okay, well, what do we mean by attention? What we mean by attention literally isn't just any sort of attention. Like, hey, you, what are you doing over there? Hey, notice me. No, that isn't what's going on. The attention that we're talking about is that the needy person is needing and craving esteem signals. They are wanting signals from the other individual through whatever communication channel is available. So that it could be a needy girlfriend on the other side of the country that's on the phone all night long, and all you've got to do, the only thing you can do is talk on the phone. Okay. However, it could be that someone is feeling they're living in the same house and they're feeling very needy of evidence that they are found sexually desirable. So they want to be hugged and they want to be touched and they want to be caressed. Okay. Or they might be a little more verbal in the way they are work, and so they want compliments. The point is that they want is signals. They want signals that they are esteemed or valued. When you do not receive signals that you are esteemed or valued, you are very likely to exhibit needy behavior. Okay, so this is he calls this a trait. Neediness is not typically a trait. Okay, neediness is a state. Neediness is something that arises in the organism when it's in trouble, when it's feeling deprivation and it's feeling anxiety. So you are not needy for food all the time, but you can get very needy for food if you don't have any for 3 or 4 days, or water, or a blanket, okay, or sleep, okay, or cues from your partner that you value very greatly that you are found desirable as well, okay? So this is a mistake, so this guy's advice would be quit acting needy. But the truth of the matter is the person that's acting needy can't just quit acting needy any more than they could say, well, quit whining about being hungry, okay? Well, if you're hungry, you know, you can't just tell somebody, well, quit being hungry. You can't tell somebody, just quit being needy. You can't quit being needy. You are needy because you are in an anxious state where you feel a relationship slipping away. And you are desiring reassurance from the other party. And so that is what is actually transpiring here. Now, of course, we've all met people who were, quote, very needy a lot. There are personalities that are, you know, essentially pretty, what do you call it? I don't know what we would call it. Neurotic, pathetic, sad, sack people, highly unstable, et cetera. Highly neurotic individuals. So, of course, there are such individuals. We certainly aren't going to talk them out of it, and it's not important that we instruct them very much on a romantic process. The people that we're interested in talking to about romantic process to be wiser and smarter about it are the normal people like us. And I don't know about you, Nate, but in my long and very boring but actually checkered history in the romantic front, I have occasionally been needy, okay? I've been in situations where I felt over-rewarded in a relationship. The woman seemed fancier than myself, and I could feel that I was not getting feedback from her that was essentially reassuring feedback, and so therefore I felt needy for the positive feedback. And I felt all the anxiety that we feel when we're about to get dumped. And incidentally, whenever I felt that, I did get dumped. So that was an absolute perfect correlation that anytime I was feeling that, I wound up getting dumped. And so this is hopefully this clarifies this for our listeners, that this is not a trait and it's not actually something that you can change. It's actually a signal telling you that you are absolutely in the wrong place, but not to worry because you're about to be kicked to the curb. And so the wrong place will soon change.
How's that for a dose of reality?
There you go.
You see, like when you say this, it, in my mind, I start to think about the pop psychology and some of the different approaches that are out there. And a lot of them, they don't really tell patients this. What they seek to do is to tell the spouse, here's how you send signals of status and value to your partner so that they don't feel quite as needy.
Right.
However, the person who was feeling like checking out of the relationship is like, well, I'm not really valuing them, but I can say the right words so that they can stop being upset at me.
Yes. And this is a fiasco, but this is sort of standard marital therapy where one partner is feeling needy and clingy because they're getting rejection cues, and the other partner is hauled in front of the therapist and instructed about how it is that we're going to put out this fire of unquenchable thirst on the part of the person that's being rejected. And I have actually seen with my own eyes some of the most pathetic signal cues of acceptance from the person who is actually sending rejection cues. And, of course, that's about like having a big city sewer with a massive crack in it, and you're out there with some duct tape, okay? That there's just no stopping this process, and that relationship is knee-deep in shit in no time. So, we're not going to wish these processes away. When someone is very needy and clingy, there's a good reason, and it's because they are effectively overvalued in the relationship. The other party feels undervalued in the relationship dynamics. In other words, they feel like they are not getting appropriate value for what it is that they have to trade in romance, and they are essentially shopping their alternatives out there in the world, and the relationship is, you know, it's effectively at best on hold.
So what do you advise your patients if they come in and one person is saying, the complaint is, well, this person's being really needy. What do you do in that situation?
Well, I'll just tell you about a typical situation. The this is something that has happened many times in my career. So I could give you essentially a composite example. So a woman comes in. Been married 10 years, and early in the marriage, early in the relationship, there's some sexuality, not too much, and it cools off, but there's a great friendship that then turns into a marriage between two relatively young people. And 10 years later, there's been essentially no sex in this relationship. There's been very little sex. It's been the man has been not interested hardly at all. They've been to sex therapy. You know, they've tried toys. She's, you know, done her hair 18 different ways, et cetera. There seems to be no solution. And now, so the person comes in, you know, once in a blue moon, somebody will walk in, and they literally are mystified. They don't. What's interesting about this is that the person sort of knows, but they sort of don't know. And so it's interesting and what I do in these situations is I'm very careful to ask very carefully about the sexual dynamics early in the relationship. I want to know what that first year looked like. I want to know what the first 3 or 4 months looked like. The reason is that tells us a tremendous amount about whether the person could ever possibly qualify again. So if I had a situation where the marriage was very hot and heavy for a year, you know, a year before they got married. And then after they got married, then it turns out that it all cooled down, and then it's right now it's stone cold. Now, we may be dead in the water, but we might not be dead in the water because something may have changed fundamentally. The woman may have gained 30 pounds. Who knows? She may have female problems, and she may be inorgasmic and frustrated. Who knows what the issues are? But the issues are worth talking about if they ever had really good chemistry, okay? Now, usually they will report that they did not have very good chemistry. What they had was they had some loving processes. They feel like they're very great friends, et cetera. But the man was never heavily pursuing the female, for example, over the course of a year, okay? It's unlikely that the man pursued the female heavily over the course of a year, and now we have a situation where if she is not changed in her physical appearance, that it's dead in the water. Now, so very often I have these situations, and when I have these situations, it turns out that when I and it's not always that the female is being rejected. This could absolutely be the other direction. The female could be coming to me saying, I have no interest in sex with my husband, okay? So that also, I've seen it both ways. And either way, the solution is, the solution to the mystery is the same. And that is that somebody doesn't qualify. And so as a therapist, I explain the fact that the nervous system essentially works very much like a bargain hunter at Macy's. That you're there looking for something really good, and if the cost is low enough and the value is high enough, you can't stop yourself. You've got to buy it, okay? It's a cost-benefit analysis, and you're excited about it. That's exactly what romance is. It's a cost-benefit analysis. It's the most all-encompassing cost-benefit analysis that there is. It's the biggest decision that people make in their lives. And so as a result, it's a very complicated cost-benefit analysis, but it certainly is a cost-benefit analysis. And it's going to turn out it's complicated by the fact that very often the male will be interested enough in the female because she qualifies as a casual mating partner, and she may qualify as a great friend. And so let's use some numbers here just to give a feel for this. Let's suppose these two people are a pair of eights, but the male by nature is wanting to only commit to a nine because he feels like he needs to be over rewarded in the looks department, which is a very standard operating procedure for our species. So a pair of eights meet, and the female meets criteria for casual mating, but she does not meet criteria for pair bond strategy. He's not excited enough. Now, turns out that she's a great person, and that they wind up being wonderful friends, and they can tell that very early. So now you have a situation where the guy, if he's very stable, honorable, highly conscientious, very decent kind of a person, he can see that he qualifies as a pair bond or a long-term love strategy for the female who's falling in love with him. And they've had sex, 12 or 15 times over 3 months or whatever the hell it is. In other words, it's not hot and heavy, but it's there. And the female is very comfortable and is actually happy with, allowing herself to be sexually vulnerable to this man. The man was sort of interested. What the heck? He didn't really start out to get this deep into the wicket, but he's there. And so then what can happen is they feel like they've got to sort of do the right thing. They don't want to lose a best friend, and they go ahead and marry this girl because that's what she wants. Maybe the relationship drags on for another year, having sex a couple times a month, and then at the end of a year, they decide to get married, and then 10 years later, it's not a couple of times a month. It's now 4 times a year, okay? Now, I will tell people that at that point, you have to understand that you don't qualify. So if you're a male and your wife is not into you, then she's dodging you at every turn, then you don't qualify. And if you're a female and your husband is not chasing you around, trying to nail you a couple of times a week, you don't qualify. Okay? And maybe if you once qualified, then there's a possibility that we can do some remedial work on what has happened in terms of sex appeal on everybody's part. And maybe we can change that. But if it was never there strong early, that it's never going to be there. And so I will tell people, like I said, I've had this conversation many times, and I will explain to people when I hear their story, you don't qualify, okay? And that's just the way it is. You qualify to be a great friend. You may qualify to be a lifetime friend. You may qualify to be the most trusted business partner. You may qualify to be a fabulous mother to the guy's children, for God's sake, that you may have had 3 of them. But you don't qualify to be a romantic love, okay? And if you don't qualify to be a romantic love, you don't. And no amount of stomping our foot at reality or insisting that things are going to be different or that we're going to do marriage therapy or sexual counseling or sexual instruction or anything, none of it's going to help. Because these issues of whether or not we qualify or don't qualify are the most right brain, intuitive, absolutely involuntary responses that there are. They are essentially the same responses as whether or not you like a piece of pizza, okay? You either like the piece of pizza or you don't like the piece of pizza. You know, I cannot stand cilantro. And I can remember a woman on Match.com that was writing about herself, and she said, and by the way, I can't understand why anybody would ever want to eat cilantro. And I chuckled. I thought, there's my soulmate. Okay? That's exactly how I feel about cilantro. If there's the slightest bit of cilantro in my tostada or my taco, I push it away. I'm not going to eat it. Okay? And yet somebody else, it's a much-loved spice. Fair enough. Okay? The bottom line is we can't make ourselves, you know, the Bonnie Raitt song said it better than it's ever been said. I can't make you love me if you won't. Okay? You can't make your heart feel something it won't. That's just how it is. And so that's what I tell people. I tell them gently and I tell them intelligently and I explain it, but that, you know, that is the story.
Yeah, one of these days we're going to have to get you up at a karaoke bar and have you sing that song for us.
Not likely.
Yeah, you know,
when I was
much younger, I went on a first date with a girl, and I'd been maybe after that I went on a couple more dates, and I was talking to my grandparents, who I consider pretty wise, and they've been together for 60 years, and they're exactly what you talked about. I still catch my grandpa. My grandma will be in the kitchen, like, cooking something, and I'll catch him pinching her behind as a joke, and she does the same thing. So they just got this beautiful, you know, relationship that you can tell there's still passion there. But I was talking to them about this girl that I had been dating for a couple of dates, and I said, Grandpa, you know, I like her. She's cute, but our conversations is just awkward. So I'm thinking maybe it'll take a little bit of time to get to know her, and then it won't be quite so awkward. And he said, you know what? Don't worry about it. If it's awkward from the first 5 seconds, it will always be awkward.
Yeah. Yeah, there's an old wise man that has seen an awful lot of human nature play out. And I would say that obviously the great Jane Austen novel, Pride and Prejudice, is a contradiction of what he's saying. But I would say my friend that I tell the story of that met the girl in the restaurant, he actually has a saying about his history and relationships. And he says, when it's good, you know it. And when it's not good, you know it. And that's, and you can, you know, a date too, if everything is not good on date two, we're in trouble. The system is designed actually to give people the benefit of the doubt. Particularly if you're a male. And so the system is absolutely designed for the benefit of the doubt. And so we should be excited and hopeful and actually probably looking past some red flags that we very may well see, you know, 6 weeks from now that we're not seeing now. So, I think I would give your uncle a 90% accurate on that comment. We're going to reserve 10%. For rare events. We'll give them a third date. You know, they've got an awful lot of solid objective characteristics, and there's an awful lot of value there. It's a fine person, but it's not the right flavor. Give it a little bit more time, but then, you know, when you know it, you know it.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's move on along to the next section of this dating coach. The next reason why relationships fail in his mind is jealousy. So here we go.
Okay.
Yes, this is another big reason why relationships don't work out. Being too controlling over your partner will actually give you less control in the end. Typically, the more controlling a partner gets, the more the other partner will try and break free. And eventually when that happens, there's almost no turning back. So if you were guilty of this, you need to learn to manage your jealousy. It's a huge sign of insecurity, and it's never going to actually have any benefit or positive outcome. Jealousy is a natural emotion all humans will feel, unless you're, you know, a sociopath. So the key is controlling that jealousy rather than controlling your partner.
Well, that's sort of a sort of so-so pathetic comment. So let's look at the facts. The facts are that jealousy is a signal that your relationship is under threat from a competitor. The if you are, it's a designed neural circuit. It's, as he says, it's natural. These neural circuits work slightly different in males and females. It's going to turn out that this distinction between male and female circuitry with respect to the jealousy mechanism was first discovered by Dr. David Buss, now at the University of Texas, and probably the world's leading authority on human mating behavior. Any of you that are interested in reading more about Dr. Buss's work, you can. His classic is called The Evolution of Desire. And it's a you know, encyclopedic kind of sort of expose on how human beings work. Now, what Buss found was that male sexual jealousy and female sexual jealousy are quite different. It turns out that males are much more upset about infidelity than females, and that is because of the different biological costs, genetic costs that are in play. You have to understand that these mechanisms, the mechanisms of the neural circuits that give rise to the experience of jealousy, were shaped under ancestral conditions in Africa in the last 2 million years. And so the when this species became a pair bond species, when the males started investing in offspring, this is when jealousy would have started to become part of human evolution. The there is no jealousy. There is no sexual jealousy when an animal, one wolf or one fox mates with another fox in the woods and then walks off, and then the female may mate with some other fox, you know, two days later. There's no jealousy mechanism because the male is not intending to use some of his life blood and work and invest in the offspring that he may have created. When you have a pair bond species, when a male is going to stick around with a female and invest in her and feed her and protect her and feed her offspring, then if that's going to happen, you are going to get jealousy mechanisms evolving in that species, and you do. So it's not just in humans. You'll see this, essentially all over nature. And so the you'll also see some sexual jealousy in interesting other species that are not pair bond species. But this clearly is a pair bond species type of situation. So human beings exhibit this. And males exhibit it in a tremendous anger. And in fact, their reaction very often is to leave the relationship. Okay? So they're essentially, the cost benefit is, if I cannot know that the child is going to be mine, I'm sure as hell not going to stick around and defend you and feed you and then feed your offspring if there's a good chance it's not my offspring. So the males tend to be much more dramatic in their willingness to break off a relationship than a female. Now, a female has I'm not saying that females don't feel that way and they don't behave that way, but I'm just telling you that they do not have the same level of resolution when this happens as males do. That is because females face a different adaptive problem. So if a man is in a sexual relationship with a female, and then it turns out he's also having a sexual relationship with another female, then what the female actually has is a rival for that male's time and energy and attention. She does not have a problem that this may not be her child that he is creating by having sex with her. It is absolutely her child, and he's absolutely the father. And so her problem is more about fighting over resources than it is literally the entire enchilada. So it's about how many of his resources is she going to get. If he's still willing to, quote, come home with her, come home to her, that she may be able to, quote, fight for him and win him away from the rival, then he's still absolutely worth having because no other male on earth will be as invested in her offspring as this guy who is the father. And so as a result, females' reaction to infidelity is quite a bit different than males' reaction to infidelity. They may act like they're going to break off a relationship, but they tend to not do so. They may storm and scream and yell and cry, and they may throw a big fuss. But the bottom line is if the guy's willing to come home, they'll probably take him back. Okay? That is because the cost-benefit in the situation, in essentially the Stone Age dynamics that are running this, are dictating that is probably the best option for her. So as a result, so now we're going to back up and see if, quote, jealousy is the cause of relationships' demise like this young man thinks. It is not the cause of the demise of relationships. This is a mistake, as once again, they are mistaking correlation with causation. So if you see a relationship that is full of jealousy processes, it is not the jealousy processes that are causing the relationship's demise. It is, in fact, the fact that there is one individual in that relationship that is exhibiting behavior that indicates that they are defecting. Okay? That is causing the other individual to feel jealous. Okay? So their response, the jealousy mechanism, is a protective mechanism for that individual's situation. And they are essentially trying to threaten and negotiate, et cetera, their partner. That's what that they're trying to do. Females, when they become jealous, actually are recognizing that they have sexual competitors that are more enticing than they are. And it turns out that they start working on their looks. They start losing weight. They start going to the gym. They start painting their nails. They start sharpening up their clothes. They start getting their hair tinted, et cetera. In other words, they strive to be more competitive while it is that they're signaling that they're jealous, okay? Whereas males, if they have a sexual competitor in the situation, they're likely to be walking out, jumping in their truck, and leaving, okay? So that is – so et cetera. Now, they may – there may be obviously more dynamics and yelling and some very – as they say, you know, what's going to – you know, what's this – I don't know, the joke is, what's the same thing as a tornado in an Oklahoma divorce? You know, somebody's losing a mobile home. And, you know, when this all, there's big drama, there may be some eggs flying around the room, et cetera. But it isn't the jealousy process that is causing the problem. The jealousy process is a symptom of the problem. Now, one last caveat. Obviously, if we have a highly disagreeable, narcissistic, controlling nutcase of a male, okay, that has a female who loves him and honors him and only has sex with him and only has eyes for him, and yet he feels so over-rewarded and is so naturally insecure and touchy that he feels like other men are going to get into her pants when she goes to the store, and he acts all very controlling and like a nutcase, then can he cause the demise of the relationship? Of course. But the demise of that relationship was inevitable. Okay? We're not going to instruct him out of that situation because that's who that guy is. Okay? So once again, to instruct people that jealousy is the cause of a problem of relationship is absurd. It is not the cause. It is the effect of problems in the relationship. And furthermore, it turns out that the actual scientific research on this topic very clearly indicates that couples that have occasional bouts of jealousy are actually the couples that are in fact the happiest couples. It turns out that if you value your partner so much that it turns out that if they get some attention from other people, it causes you anxiety, that you feel the upsettedness of having to protect your relationship from rivals, that's a good thing, okay? This is in fact a great test for people out there that wonder if they are sort of in a flat relationship and that it's their best friend, they've been married 14 years, but, you know, I don't know, am I really in the right place? Ask yourself this question. Ask yourself, if your partner slept with somebody else, what would you think? And if the answer is, oh, boy, that'd be great. Hey, have at it. Knock yourself out. If that's the answer that comes out in your nervous system, then we know a tremendous amount about where your relationship is at.
Yeah, it's it reminds me again, same grandparents who gave me that advice about the awkwardness with that beautiful
yes.
relationship. Whenever they used to argue, they would always compete as to who could leave the other and get more mates.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I very clearly remember them doing this, and my grandpa said something about how he could go and get dates, you know, anytime he wanted, and she goes, and of course, this is my grandmother at 65 years old, and she goes, look at this body. I could go outside and get any younger man.
And that's great. So you're seeing the sort of recurrent theme of occasional jealousy and anxiety about their partner's work in the world of competitors, and that's a wonderful thing that hopefully people don't see it too often in a relationship, but if they never see it, then that's probably not actually the best sign. I'm not saying that you can't have a relationship and never have that experience, but I would consider that to be unusual for our species.
All right, next one is falling into a boring routine.
Yes. Okay, let's hear the genius.
Both men and women have an equal desire for fun and excitement. The need for adventure and excitement varies from person to person, but nobody wants to be stuck in the same boring routine forever. Every relationship needs to have some element of fun and excitement. You don't have to go skydiving every week or, you know, wear a different ridiculous costume when you have sex with your partner, but you do need to keep things interesting and avoid being too complacent. Often when the spark fades and a relationship stops being, you know, new and exciting, neither partner will make any real effort to keep things interesting, and that's a huge mistake. You need to make sure that your partner's having fun and maintains their interest in you and your relationship. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news here, but even the best relationships require some maintenance to work. So if you want to live happily ever after, then both you and your better half need to put in the work to avoid to keep the spark alive and avoid falling into a boring, passionless routine.
I understand what he's trying to say, and I understand the sort of timeless advice that he's giving us that it seems to be something that couldn't possibly be wrong. So it seems like the safe kind of health advice that we hear about, drink two or three more glasses of water a day, can't possibly hurt you and can only do you good. But I would say that it's fundamentally wrong what he's telling us. Now, why? The people that eat, for example, very healthy food, they do not get tired of very healthy food. They get satiated to the point where they're not hungry for a while. And then what happens is that the homeostatic drive mechanisms that exist inside of people will then cause them to be hungry again. And the same thing is true with your sleep mechanism. So your sleep mechanism will actually, you will feel tired as you get further on in the day, and then you will get very sleepy, and then you will sleep, and if you sleep to satiation, you wake up the next morning. We cannot get you to sleep. It's not possible. We'd have to do some brain damage of some kind, hit you on the head, give you a drug, et cetera. But there's no way that you could take a fully satiated brain, a sleep-satiated brain, and put it to sleep. You can't do it, okay, because you have homeostatic drive mechanisms that are driving these behaviors. Now, it's going to turn out that if you qualify for your mate and your mate qualifies for you, then what's going to happen is that there's going to be homeostatic drive mechanisms that are going to rise up and make sex a priority. Now, let's back up, because it actually isn't boring routine that will get in the way of people's sex lives. It's actually getting overwhelmed with too many ancillary projects will get in the way. So if you have too many things tugging at your attention, and you are working very hard to rise in dominance hierarchies and get more resources so that you can have fancier displays, or that you're having to push your children very, very hard because you want them to get better grades so that they can get to a better school, so that they can then have a fancier career, et cetera. In other words, the normal human relentless push for trying to display their gene quality can lead to people being, you know, essentially exhausted, overwhelmed, et cetera. Now, it's going to turn out that the job of the nervous system is to guide behavior along two general lines. The first goal is survival, and the second goal is reproduction. And so it's going to turn out that the goals are always in that order. It is survival first and then reproduction. So it's going to turn out you better not be doing reproductive behavior unless we can make sure we can survive. That's way too risky. So as a result, we can essentially expand out a lot of survival behavior and get an awful lot of irons in the fire to the point where there seems to be no time left over for reproductive behavior, and then we've made a mistake. Okay? So I would not say that you have to do things to, quote, keep your relationship alive and keep things interesting and new. I think this is ludicrous. Can you imagine people in the Stone Age saying, oh, I don't know, sure wish you had some purple lingerie, you know what I'm saying? Of course not. You know what I'm saying? Maybe we should change up the music, okay? Of course not. There is no way that this is true, okay? The issue is, do we have enough leisure where people are well-rested enough, healthy enough, fit enough, okay? Are they a good rendition of themselves, and do they still qualify for their partner? If that's true, and they have enough time and energy, and that they've made essentially the romantic time in their lives where they are just together and it's quiet and they're not overwhelmed, et cetera, then sexual impulses arise spontaneously in the system, and nothing fancy needs to happen any more than we need to doctor up our food to like it a lot. Okay, so again, a little bit there of a misunderstanding about what is actually going wrong in human relationships. But, you know, I can't beat him up too much for those mistakes. But he's indicating a lack of understanding of how this really works. I had a couple that clearly had a great love relationship, and the first 8 years of their relationship, they were very spontaneous and sexual, and to quote the woman, she says, well, things have changed now after we've had two children. We don't do it in other people's bathrooms anymore. Okay? So this was very spontaneous people, okay, and very very much into each other, et cetera. And so they did not go on a vacation and spend overnight together for more than 10 years after they had their first child. So their first child, by the time their first child was about 10 and their second child was 8, was the first time they allowed themselves to park those children with relatives. And they then, at my instigation, actually, in my encouragement, they went down to the Caribbean and they had a week by themselves. And I heard back from her. She said, it was exactly as you had anticipated it, that it took us a day or two to catch up on her sleep. And then when that happened, our sexuality came back very, very strong and remained that way beautifully for the whole week. Okay? So that, in other words, they still qualified for each other. And what was getting in the way, it wasn't that the relationship was without sexuality, but it was much muted because these two very hardworking, highly conscientious people had just too many irons in the fire to allow sex to be a priority in the relationship. And so as soon as they got a break, it came back. As all the survival problems were solved on vacation, there was nothing to think about and no work to be done. It rose back into the middle of the relationship just like we would anticipate. So that is the prescription that I would give people. If you qualify and your partner qualifies, you know, for goodness sakes, you need to know that that is very special. It's not typical of human beings. And if you have that situation, you should protect it against all the ambitious nonsense that goes on with people in our modern world.
So when we're looking for beautiful relationships, we are –
yes.
Sometimes a partner will say one thing, but they'll mean something completely different. So
mm-hmm.
What I'm going to play is a couple of humorous clips. And
yes.
A few seconds long where the female relationship, and she says one thing, and then she actually says exactly what she's thinking. So we'll just get a quick reaction from you.
Sure.
Babe, what are you thinking? I'm just bored. Analyzing you is fun.
Very good. Yeah, so hopefully some of this can be useful for people as they think about some things. Some of the most important things to know is that if you're in actually something, a relationship that's quite healthy, where you feel attraction to your partner and they to you, and you're also very good friends, then this is special, and it should be defended. It should be defended very intelligently, because and with a lot of assertiveness against the outside world and as well as the ambitions from within. And if you're not in that situation, it isn't to say, when I speak about these things, this isn't to say that two people that are married together and they've been married for 20, 25 years and have had two or three children, et cetera, and there's really no chemistry left in their lives, but they're good friends. But this is, you know, I'm not telling you to get a divorce or kiss your mother goodbye. What I am saying is that these are choices, and there are consequences, and the consequences are likely to be that your nervous system has a greater upside to life experience than the one that you're experiencing now. You may never find it. There's no guarantees. It may not be worth it in terms of the cost benefit for you. And there's nothing in the world wrong with people living in relationships with a best friend who is no longer a lover. What I'm interested in personally is not so much that situation. I'm interested in the intelligent seeking of the optimal experiences that human beings can have. And so that's why the dynamics of romance and romantic love and sex and sexuality, how these things all play in to human nature and human nature's potential is infinitely fascinating and, to me, of great importance.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.